but at your best, you are love. You're a positive motivating force within my life. Should you ever feel the need to wonder why, let me know, let me
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with our special guest, Ralph Nader. We talk with him about the underreporting of fatalities in the Gaza Strip.
Ralph Nader believes that the undercount of deaths in Gaza Strip is massive. He also talks with us about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the sense of dread that people are feeling now.
We speak with Professor David Myers about U.S. foreign policy regarding the war in Gaza and the campus protests that have emerged around that issue. Professor Myers is a distinguished professor of Jewish history at UCLA.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
The Americans supported Israeli war against the 2.3 million people in Palestine living in the Gaza Strip continues on since last October. The area, the size of Philadelphia, has been partially obliterated by American fighters, bombers, bombs, tanks, artillery shells, and bullets. The number of dead Palestinians is at least 186,000, according to a recent article in the prestigious British medical journal The Lancet. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has just left Washington, D.C., where he came to solidify his support in our Congress. It was his fourth visit. Biden's support for the genocide has not been vigorously challenged by Kamala Harris, his choice to replace him. Her election is doubtful, and Donald Trump has vowed to, quote, finish the job, end quote. We speak today with attorney Ralph Nader. His latest article contends that the number of dead in Gaza is even higher than the 39,000-plus figure set by Israel, America, and Hamas. We have the honor to speak with Ralph. He's an attorney, a significant figure in American politics, and a four-time presidential candidate in parties independent of the Republicans and the Democrats. Ralph Nader has recently written two excellent books, Out of Darkness, Essays on Corporate Power and Civic Resistance, and Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country that Works for the People. Attorney Ralph Nader, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Ralph, before we talk about the new situation with the Democratic Party switching Harris for Biden, I wanted to talk to you about an article that you recently wrote where you say that the casualties, the deaths in Gaza, have been massively misrepresented. You believe that at least 300,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. I wanted to ask you, you're skeptical about this figure. Why?
It's a massive undercount because Hamas and Netanyahu have the same interest in undercounting fatalities and other casualties for different reasons. Hamas doesn't want the true count to even be estimated because it would inflict more criticism by their own people that they can't protect after October 7th the Palestinian people in Gaza and provide them with shelters. Netanyahu, of course, with his genocidal attack on all civilian facilities, likes the undercount as well. So the official count, based largely on a declining report from what's left of the hospitals and morgues, is just under 40,000. This after 9 months of daily bombing of homes, apartment buildings, schools, mosques, marketplaces, refugee centers, hospitals, health facilities, ambulances, electric systems, water mains, no protection for the civilians, the families, the children, the babies, no shelters. They're not allowed in the tunnels. It's inconceivable. Most of the Gazans have survived this kind of daily assault. You have an interview by Al Jazeera of the head of a small burial team in two cemeteries in Gaza. He estimates he and his team alone have buried, often in mass graves, 17,000 Palestinians. And that was from October 8th to February. He also indicated many of the cemeteries have been bulldozed by Israeli bulldozers as they destroy every possible evidence of Gaza's livelihood and cultural life. They have destroyed all the universities, the libraries, the museums, all the governmental buildings, of course, not to mention most of the schools. So here we have three layers of causation of death: the direct violence of F-16s, naval artillery, tanks, and snipers. Then there's the secondary effects of the genocidal orders by the Israeli Minister of Defense after October 7th. There will be no food, no water, no medicine, no electricity, no fuel, nothing. Those are not mere words of rhetoric. They are orders which have been implemented day by day. So you have poisoned or contaminated water, which leads to heavy diarrhea deaths among young children and infants. You have starvation as a weapon of war. All of this has been addressed by UN humanitarian agencies, Doctors Without Borders, the World Food Program, the Central Kitchen Group, whose seven valiant volunteers were killed by Israel a number of weeks ago. And then you have 5,000 babies born every month. Where are they born into? The rubble? There are no maternity wards. There's no health care. There's no food. The mothers are semi-starving. They can't feed their infants. And the air is incredibly polluted, massive pollution, far, far greater than what occurred after 9/11 in southern Manhattan. And it's day after day. There is respiratory ailments, coughing. There is no insulin for 55,000 diabetics. How long do you last if you're a serious diabetic condition without insulin? There are 75,000 serious cancer cases before October 7th. There's no cancer medicine. The healthcare system is not only in shambles, but the Israelis have killed hundreds of healthcare workers, and the others are semi-starved, weakened, losing members of their family. You have extended families where 200 members of Dr. Haddad, a cardiologist in Virginia's family, have been killed. Others, 150, 80. And they're trying to tell us there are only less than 40,000 deaths. So my estimate, based on these conditions, and mind you, Gaza is only the size geographically of Philadelphia. It's twice the size of the District of Columbia, with 2.3 million people, completely defenseless, the vast majority homeless, out into the elements, massive heat waves coming in, no air conditioning, obviously, no protection, and being told again and again, hundreds of thousands of people, move out, say the Israeli military. Move out from one safe designation area to another. And then they bomb the safe designation areas. They tell people to flee their homes in the early months after October 7th, and then they attack them as they're fleeing to the south on the roads. This is a level of unparalleled savagery. To use the word genocide, it's also mass terror. Netanyahu is a mega terrorist. He's not just a genocidal impactor. He's a mass terrorist. And the Israeli state terror will go down as history as one of the most vicious international law violating terrorism in modern history. To give you an example, in World War II, we set atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we firebombed Dresden. This is the U.S. military. And Netanyahu never fails to tell Blinken and Biden on their private telephone exchanges, don't lecture us. Look what you did in Nagasaki, in Hiroshima, and Dresden. Well, the total death toll in those three cities comes to about 235,000. So already the death toll in Gaza is over 300,000, and they're dying by the hour from deadly diseases. Polio viruses have been discovered in the sewage. There's hepatitis epidemics and a fear of a cholera epidemic. and there's no healthcare system operating, a few hospitals barely open. To make matters worse, there are thousands of humanitarian aid trucks lined up for miles out in Egypt, ready to go into Gaza, paid for by the U.S. taxpayer, and Biden can't even get Netanyahu to open the gates. It's another violation of international law. Netanyahu, despised by 3 out of 4 Israelis, under indictment and prosecution by his own Israeli prosecutors for political corruption, and hated for his disastrous collapse of a multi-tier, super-modern border defense system on October 7th. He's violated just about every war crime under international law that can be listed, which is why the International Criminal Court is working toward holding him accountable. So you have all the perfect storm for perhaps 700,000 Gazans dying by the end of the year. Already, last December, the Global Health Department chief at the University of Edinburgh gave an interview to the Guardian newspaper saying that 500,000 Palestinians will die in 2024 if conditions remain. Well, conditions are much worse. This kind of genocide is cumulative. Starvation doesn't start immediately. It accelerates in terms of its lethal toll, as is the case with diseases and in the failure of any possible healthcare system due to the direct bombardment. The very idea that Netanyahu can tell a supine, sadistic Congress led by the fanatic House Speaker, Michael Johnson, who gave this mass murderer, this terrorist, on a grand scale, 50 standing ovations. No president in the United States has had that kind of accolade. That's the level of complicity and co-belligerency that will mark the careers of these Republicans and some of the Democrats for the rest of their political lives. And as a result, what we're seeing here is the continued backing by Biden and the Congress, with increasing opposition among some 100 Democrats, I might add, for more arms, more bombs, more diplomatic and political coverage, more vetoes of Security Council resolutions trying to stop this war with a permanent ceasefire and the influx of humanitarian aid. So this is where we are, a mighty nation operating like a tail of a renegade, genocidal Israeli state terror, not only against the Palestinians in Gaza, but against the Palestinians in the West Bank, and desiring to draw the U.S. into a military war against Iran and perhaps the Houthis in Yemen beyond what the U.S. is now bombing because of the attack on the Red Sea shipping lanes by the Houthis in solidarity with the defenseless Palestinians. Now, it always has to be reminded, Michael, Hamas was a tiny religious group, and the Israelis alerted the U.S. many decades ago in the 80s that Hamas can be built up as a counterpoint to the Secular Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, headed by Arafat, and neutralized them. And they learned that Hamas is opposed to any two-state solution. So in speeches to his own party, Likud, Netanyahu bragged about not only helping Hamas and supporting Hamas, but facilitating the funding of Hamas. And a year before October 7th, Israeli military intelligence got the exact plans that were executed by Hamas once they saw the collapse, mysterious collapse, still uninvestigated officially, of the most sophisticated border apparatus, technological, human intelligence, massive surveillance, spies, informants, and spotters. Suddenly, all collapsed on October 7th. How mysterious. There's more to come out here, but that's my analysis.
Ralph, thanks for that. I do want to talk with you about the Republicans and Democrats, but could you first briefly address the issue of the U.S.-Israeli alliance? You've said its influence is far greater than even our military-industrial complex and the combined strength of the Jewish and Christian Zionists. What do our listeners need to know about this alliance?
Well, what we need to know is a lesson for all civic groups. That if you control Congress for universal health care, living wage, cracking down on corporate crime, that's all you need. And that's what AIPAC has shown. AIPAC and its allies are spectacularly organized. They have people back in the districts of every member of Congress. They know their doctors, their golf companions, their lawyers, their social friends, the clubs they belong to, and they take advantage of that. Back in Washington, as Republican Congressman Tom Massey has related, they have a minder. They have a person on every member of Congress. Could be a person back in the district or part of their volunteer or paid staff in Washington. And so Tom Massey says that when he talks to his Republican colleagues, asks them questions about the Israeli-Palestine issue, they often say to him, Tom, I'll get back to you after I check with my AIPAC man. Check with your AIPAC man? Tom Massey said. What kind of independent judgment is that? Then, of course, there's the alliance with the military-industrial complex. The Lockheed, Raytheon, Boeing, They love all these military contracts and giveaways to the Israelis because it means more money. So that's an unspoken alliance right there on Congress. It's pretty hard for Congress to stand up to those two kinds of lobbies. So what we're seeing here is a subversion of our own civil liberties in the country, all kinds of censorship now being imposed on anybody who went to a pro-Palestinian rights rally. Law firms are stigmatizing and excluding law school graduates who have spoken out against this genocide led by firms like Sullivan and Cromwell. You have people losing their jobs, having events canceled, awards revoked, not by people who are supporting Netanyahu's terror and genocide in Gaza, and violation of federal law and international law, but by people who are trying to stand up for the defenseless babies and children and women and men in Palestine, both Gaza and the West Bank. Remember, most of these casualties are children and women. They've slaughtered at least 100,000 children, blood on Netanyahu and his extreme right-wing coalition hands. All you got to do is read the reports of 16 Israeli human rights groups who had an open letter to Biden on December 13th in the New York Times saying, stop the catastrophe in Gaza, Mr. President. 16 courageous human rights groups like B'Tselem, like the Refusnik Reservists, Rabbis for Human Rights. Just look at what they're saying. They know what they're talking about, and they speak the truth. So it's not just what we're doing over there and the prospects of a wider war. And remember, Israel is a nuclear power. It's what the Israeli regime is doing to our democracy, taking over our Congress, suppressing dissent of our representatives, undermining our election integrity, violating our civil liberties, and becoming more and more virulent in funding domestic pressure groups to further stifle dissent, especially among the young people on campuses and groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, and other similar Jewish American groups who have been demonstrating extraordinary courage including leading the demonstrations against Netanyahu's genocidal speech before Congress. Remember, Nancy Pelosi has been a staunch supporter of Israel for decades. She broke ranks. She refused to be present at the Netanyahu address, and she said that Netanyahu's speech was the most disgraceful performance by a former head of state ever to address the U.S. Congress in history. So maybe we're seeing a breaking here of the ranks. Senators like Van Hollen and Murphy and Merkley are starting to be, and of course Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are starting to speak out more forcefully. But still, the vast majority of the Congress is in the pockets of the AIPAC lobby and its allies. And they have a lot of PACs, too, access to and direct PACs, AIPAC, funneling money. They have a stick-and-carrot scheme honed to perfection. If you do what they say, they praise you, they give you money, they make sure there's no primary opponent. If you dare oppose them, as Jamal Bowman modestly early supported for a ceasefire, that was his crime, they go against you, spend millions of dollars, and they defeated him in the primary. Now they're going after Congresswoman Cori Bush for their primary struggle in St. Louis.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. We're speaking with Attorney Ralph Nader. You're listening to Law and Disorder. Ralph, people feel a sense of dread at the gathering of the current political storm. Trump has promised to institute a vast program of deportation. He's a climate denier. He's vowed to dismantle the administrative state. And now with the Supreme Court decision in Trump versus America, a president will be granted immunity from any criminal prosecution for any acts that he or she has committed officially. Do you feel a sense of dread?
Well, clearly, this is the most rogue Supreme Court in our history, and they basically produced a decision that will transform an elected president of the United States into a king, a monarch, going back to what our revolutionaries in 1776 revolted against, the doctrine that the king can do no wrong. And 6-3, the rogue majority provided unparalleled immunities for what presidents can get away with, delighting the serial law and constitution violator Donald Trump to no end. Three of the six were his nominees, by the way, after Hillary Clinton collapsed her campaign and gave us Donald Trump in 2016. Also, they had a decision that would make it very hard for regulatory agencies to perform their mission of law and order and restrain the silent violence of corporate pollution and the exploitation economically and in the workplace by corporations. And the amazing thing is they put more power back into the federal judges to second-guess the EPA and OSHA and FDA and the Auto Safety Agency and the FAA and the Federal Railroad Administration. And they don't have enough judges and staff to begin to do that. There are only about 800 or so federal district judges, and they got their hands full to begin with, not to mention their long summer vacations. So this is a rogue court, and the only way to deal with it is to start a mass movement for collective impeachment of the six rogue justices on three grounds. One, erecting unbounded corporate supremacy over the rights of real human beings. Again and again, they vote to support corporations against workers, against consumers, against patients, against people who breathe, want to breathe clean air and drink clean water, against honesty in the marketplace. The second reason is that they believe in a unitary president, so to call, which is basically the king can do no wrong. Domestically or abroad, can start wars, kill people anywhere they in the world that they suspect. Of course, a lot of this has been going on under Clinton, Bush, Obama. It's just that the Supreme Court now has made it easier. And the third is that they stifle appeals to the Supreme Court under the doctrine of no standing to sue, or it's a political issue. We can't get involved. It's up to Congress. Of course, whenever it's convenient for the six rogue justices, they'll shove it over to Congress, knowing that Congress is bought and sold, as a majority at least, by corporate money. So on these three counts, they're shutting out the public, they're entrenching a monarch and protecting the monarch with immunities, and they are imposing and entrenching the corporate state, which in 1938 was described by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in a message to Congress when he said, quote, "When private power controls government, that is fascism," end quote.
How do you appreciate the new MAGA Republican Party, and how does that differ from the old Republican Party?
Well, this is an intriguing question, because who would have dreamed that a serial liar, a failed businessman, a corporate crook, a thief, an ignorant person, a narcissist would displace the Bush family influence on the Democratic Party, on the Republican Party, the Dick Cheney cohorts on the Republican Party, and the traditional liberal Republicans, what's left of them. And I'm very curious about what these excluded and attacked remnants of the old Republican Party are going to do in this election. Are they organizing? Haven't heard much from Lynn Cheney. Haven't heard much from George W. Bush or Jeb Bush. And also, there are the retired military officials who were expelled from the Trump administration, Secretaries of Defense, National Security Chief in the White House, Kelly, former general. Are they organizing at all? Or is this like 1931 Germany? Everybody's preoccupied and predisposed, while this buffoon, as he was viewed, Adolf Hitler, a barroom brawler from Austria, was arising to power. All the law firms there, the legal profession, the people in political opposition, they used to mock him before he took over and finished them off in his entrenched power and the Nazi regime. So this is what is so intriguing, is the lack of rebound and resilience by the people who used to control the Republican Party, and how they've surrendered it to the Trumpsters.
Ralph, our friend Chris Hedges, in trying to understand why Trump got 74 million votes the last time, says that he reflects the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist of the times, that he lays it all back on the Democratic Party, and really that before Reagan, in causing the loss of 30 million jobs. They don't understand what's going on. They don't understand reality. How do you appreciate that?
Well, let's analyze that. First of all, when you leave people with only two choices in a two-party duopoly, you're not going to get optimal thinking about which candidate to select. So here we have a Republican Party and Democratic Party excluding third parties, harassing them, ballot access, obstruction, never get on the debates. You know the story. As a result, here's what happens. He got over 70 million votes, to be sure. Remember, the vast majority of those votes are legacy Republican votes. They will vote for the Republican nominee regardless of who the nominee is. Doesn't matter. They would never vote for a Democrat. Add to that a virulent Trumpster dimension, because Trump is fairly astute in how to bring the worst out of people's emotions cover up his failure to do anything about improving the life of Americans where they live, work, and raise their families. He doesn't get down to that level. He basically deals with slogans, bigotry, lies, fantasies, fake promises, erroneous renditions of his record as president. Remember, he's the one who mocked the oncoming COVID pandemic. He said, oh, it's nothing, it'll be over in a few days, just a little flu. And then when it wasn't over, he mocked it again. Maybe you could drink some bleach, don't worry about it. And because he lost those critical weeks, a multiplier effect kicked in of death. And so at least 350,000 deaths would have been prevented had he, in January 2020, woken up and listened to his medical and scientific advisors. What he's done is he's made immigration a huge issue with all kinds of false statements. They're not replacing U.S. jobs. There's a huge job demand for manual labor, for example, health care, harvesting crops, cleaning buildings, etc. People from abroad are willing to do this kind of work, and a lot of Americans are not. And number two, they have a much lower crime rate in this country than the regular crime rate of people living in the U.S. And he keeps exaggerating the numbers that are coming in, which are now declining in the last few months because Biden's getting to be pretty draconian himself and trying to avoid an election issue before he dropped out. And then, of course, he raises the China issue, even though he has compromised that in many ways. And he lies. He basically tells people he's creating jobs, protecting them, and making America great again, and all kinds of dog whistles about a white Christian country and the great displacement theory. And so he gets that slice of the Republican Party into a frenzy of dedicated support.
It's been such a delight to have you on, Ralph. How can our listeners follow your work? And please remind us of the names of your two recent books.
Yeah, thanks very much, Heidi. I've had a column weekly since 1971, and you can get it automatically free by going to Nader.org and just signing up. You get it every week, 7 minutes or so of reading agitation and proposals to correct our many injustices here and around the world. And I have a radio podcast, the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, that you can access every Saturday through the podcast. It's on about 50 small radio stations around the country as well, including the community-owned radio stations, Pacifica Network. And I've come out with two books, almost back-to-back. One is a collection of my articles in recent years called Out of the Darkness, and I think it's a good gift for people who want to get young people reading again. Readers think, thinkers read is our motto. And you can read, you know, one a day, 800 to 1,000 words, on subjects that you probably never were exposed to have columnists write about, especially the corporate power and its insinuation all through our society and political economy and culture. And the other one is called Let's Start the Revolution, which is designed to arouse people in this critical election year. So when they go to vote, they vote with a mandate. They say, we're not just giving you our vote. This is the mandate that you have to observe, whether it's living wage, universal health insurance, correcting the criminal injustice system, waging peace instead of war, redirecting huge monies in a bloated military budget to rebuild America to community level with all the public services from schools to mass transit to water systems that are crumbling and being ignored so we can erect a lawless empire overseas, blowing up in various countries those very facilities.
Well, Ralph Nader, thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder. Terrific talking to you. And we hope that we'll have you back and talk again some more. And let's hope for a better outcome than we've seen so far. You take it easy.
Anytime, Michael and Heidi. Thank you very much for your own good work in this area. Bye-bye now.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Israel's brutal war in Gaza in retaliation for Hamas's savage attacks on October 7 continues to rage on. As of June 19, 2024, 37,396 people had been killed in Gaza, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, as reported by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. According to a report in the medical journal Lancet, that number is likely an underestimate. Furthermore, the UN estimates that by February 29, 35% of buildings in Gaza had been destroyed, so the number of bodies still buried in the rubble is likely substantial, with estimates of more than 10,000. Even if the conflict ends immediately, there will continue to be many indirect deaths in the coming months and years, from causes such as reproductive, communicable, and non-communicable diseases. The total death toll is expected to be large given the intensity of the conflict, destroyed healthcare infrastructure, severe shortages of food, water, and shelter, the population's inability to flee to safe places, and the loss of funding of UNRWA, one of the very few humanitarian organizations still active in Gaza. Experts believe it is not implausible to estimate that up to 163,000 or more deaths could be attributable to the current conflict in Gaza. Human rights groups believe an immediate and urgent ceasefire in Gaza is essential, accompanied by measures to enable the distribution of medical supplies, food, clean water, and other resources for basic human needs. To talk about the war in Gaza from the standpoint of American foreign policy, as well as the widespread campus protests calling for a ceasefire and Palestinian sovereignty, we've invited Professor David Myers, whom I've known and admired for decades, to join us here on Law and Disorder. David is Distinguished Professor of History at UCLA and holds the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Chair in Jewish History. He serves as the director of the UCLA Luskin Center on History and Policy, and he also directs the UCLA Initiative to Study Hate. He's the author or editor of many books in the field of Jewish history, including with Naomi Salzenberg, American Shtetl, The Making of Kiryas Joel, a Hasidic Village in Upstate New York, published by Princeton University Press in 2022. It was awarded the 2022 National Jewish Book Award in American Jewish Studies. From 2018 to 2023, David served as president of the New Israel Fund. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Steve.
So on July 24, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a joint session of Congress. He delivered a strident and unambiguous defense of Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza, and he called anti-Israel protesters, quote, Iran's useful idiots. What were your reactions to his speech? And given your own criticism of Netanyahu and his policies, David, are you one of Iran's useful idiots?
Well, thanks for those questions, Steve. I'll begin by relating to Netanyahu's speech and then get to the useful idiots quote. My reaction in a word is absolute disgust. Alas, no surprise, but Netanyahu's speech was really a cynical, staged appearance whose main audience was not the one to which he directives, his words, the United States Congress. The main audience was back home in Israel, where Netanyahu is immensely unpopular. His approval ratings hover around 30%, which is an all-time low for him. And what is notable is that the United States Congress may be the only place in the world, quite literally, where Netanyahu could be received as a statesman. Everywhere else in the world, including Israel, he is regarded as a manipulative politician, someone who puts his personal interests above that of his country. And in fact, this is really reflected in the data point that at present, more than 70% of Israelis support a deal to return the hostages through a ceasefire over a continuation of the war. The latter is what Netanyahu was attempting to promote in the Congress in his speech. Let me maybe turn to your second question. Am I one of Iran's useful idiots? Well, if so, then I must confess I am akin to those hundreds of thousands of Israelis who take to the streets every Saturday night to protest Netanyahu's intransigence, his unwillingness to prioritize the return of hostages, and his continuation of the delusional goal of eliminating Hamas. If so, I am akin to the families of the Israeli hostages who've been agitating for more concerted action to return their children to Israel. I'm akin to those hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of college students in the United States who were genuinely repulsed by the scenes of carnage in Gaza and called for a ceasefire, many of whom did so in protests across the country in the last 9 months, 9 to 10 months. If these people are useful idiots manipulated by Iran, then I proudly join them. I rather choose to see them as people of conscience who are really crying out to the world to demand accountability.
Professor David Myers, can you assess the trajectory of President Biden's response to the war in Gaza, and how do you see Kamala Harris charting her own path during the presidential election?
Well, I have to say that with some measure of humility that I've been repeatedly wrong about Biden's response to the war in Gaza. And I'd say generally his policy toward this war is perhaps the major and most significant stain on his record as president. So after the first ceasefire in November, I thought that the war would not be allowed to continue. And then it did, at which point I believe that Biden in early December would use his leverage to bring the war to an end. And he began to message to Israel that he was intending to limit the delivery of offensive weapons to Israel, which he in fact followed through on. Curiously, but not surprisingly, that action incurred the wrath of Bibi Netanyahu, who several months earlier, when Biden showed up in Tel Aviv, a little more than a week after October 7th, lauded him as one of Israel's greatest friends. So when Biden began to restrict the flow of weapons, Netanyahu turned on him. Biden had the opportunity, I think, to continue with that impulse from early December and cut off the flow of weapons to Israel so they could not continue its war, but he did not. Bibi, by the way, sort of revealed his scruples when he went from lauding Biden to castigating him in December after that restriction of war material. But Biden, the important point is Biden did not stop the war. He did not stop the flow of material. He did not tell Netanyahu to stop it. He has continued up until this moment to declare his support for Israel and its war aims, while at the same time increasing his expressions of concern over the humanitarian toll that the war has taken. And I think he did so in part out of his sincere convictions, out of his very deep sense of connection to Israel, but also as a result of a political calculation. And here I just have to say that I think that calculation was dead wrong. Biden threw in his lot with what he perceived to be the foreign policy establishment in supporting the war. And in doing so, he abandoned younger voters, especially younger voters of color, who overwhelmingly oppose the war. There's a massive generational gap in support for Biden's policy on Israel in this war. And I think Biden simply made a mistake. And this was a key point in the weakness that has been on display and that ultimately led him to drop out of the race. He, in a certain sense, left behind key Democratic constituencies by trying to have his cake and eat it too. So he supported the war. He opposed the International Criminal Court consideration of issuing a warrant against Netanyahu for war crimes. And yet he expressed concern over the humanitarian toll that the war was taking. And he even said he was not certain about whether Israel was committing war crimes, which is to say that was a possibility in his mind. I think that policy of attempting to thread the needle proved to be, on the whole, a fail. And so the question is, what will Kamala Harris do? By contrast to Biden, she has been more forthright in criticizing Israeli government policy. She called for a ceasefire before Biden did in early March. And she's been much more critical of Israel's excesses in the war than Biden, and more sympathetic to the plight of suffering Gazans. From my perspective, that offers up a sliver of hope that she'll be more forceful in constraining Israel and bringing the war to an end.
David, I know it's a huge question to ask, but as someone who observes this situation so carefully, where do you see things headed in Gaza, and where do you see American foreign policy toward Israel and the Palestinians going into 2025?
Well, I'll begin by saying that there are reports that, principally from U.S. sources, that a ceasefire deal is near. And just to remind listeners, the ceasefire deal on the table has three phases. The first would be a full and complete ceasefire for a six-week period that would be accompanied by a release of a number of Israeli hostages, principally women, elderly, and the wounded, as well as an agreement to release hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. The second phase would include the release of all remaining hostages and would entail the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. And the third phase would call for the start of major reconstruction of Gaza. On the other hand, there are a number of factors that appear on the horizon that could converge to create a different world, or at least gesture towards a world in which negotiation might be possible. And those factors are, one, a new Israeli leader, which I think is not too far off. I believe Netanyahu's day of reckoning will in fact come, and there will be a shift in leadership in Israel. Two, a new Palestinian leader. The head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is 88. He's, I think, 17 years into a four-year term. The laws of nature dictate that he will not be the Palestinian leader for that much longer. A third factor is the ongoing willingness of the Saudis and other Gulf states to be involved. I think they really represent a key, both in terms of the reconstruction of Gaza and in terms of incentivizing Israel to engage in a negotiation. This time, unlike the earlier iteration under Donald Trump in the age of the Abraham Accords, it will be impossible for those Arab partners who are considering normalization with Israel to leave behind the Palestinian question. That was one of the catalysts behind Hamas's attack in the first place, the desire to derail the seemingly imminent agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel over a normalization agreement. And the fourth factor, after considering how important it is that the Saudis and other Gulf states, other Arab states be involved, is the willingness by the United States to play the role of an honest broker and hold both sides to account. And here we get to, I think, the yawning gap between a Harris presidency and a second Trump presidency. I think it's highly unlikely that Trump would have any desire to play that role of honest broker. He has tipped his hand repeatedly toward Israel. I'd say the only caveat to that is his deep affection for the transaction, which animated his agreement to the Abraham Accords. But I think far more likely he will have no interest in applying pressure to Israel, which is really essential to a successful negotiation. I think Harris is more likely from what we have seen, to apply that pressure and to reposition the United States as an honest broker. But she is constrained by one major structural liability, which is she is not a second-term U.S. president. To really play that role of applying pressure to Israel in ways that will make a difference and apply pressure to the Palestinian side, a president needs to be in a position where she or he is not running again. So I think that's a qualified endorsement of Harris's capacity. I think she has the instincts to play that role, but she also faces serious constraints. That said, these four factors are not fantasies. A new Israeli leader, a new Palestinian leader, ongoing willingness of the Saudis, a president willing to be an honest broker. There's a sliver of hope, and we have to maximize all of our efforts to bring those four factors into a state of harmonic convergence, as we say in California.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, attorney and constitutional litigator, retired now, Steve Rohde, and we're speaking with David Myers. David, as a professor at UCLA, you're in the thick of the student protests that emerged earlier last year. What do you observe, and how would you evaluate the response of students, faculty, the administration, and the Los Angeles Police Department?
Well, thanks for that question, Michael. I was a pretty careful observer of what was going on my campus, and I would say that for a spell, it really seemed as if we were headed in the right direction. And here I'm referring not to the beginning phase of the post-October 7th campus debate turmoil, but really to a later stage, April, when the encampments began appearing across the country. The encampment at UCLA was set up on April 25th, and for at least a few days, it seemed to be quite peaceful. I visited it together with my wife and daughter, and we noticed really nothing that would be a cause for concern, as many in the pro-Israel camp had suggested. But within a week, things really had degenerated on our campus, and that was symbolized by the sequence of events on April 30th, Tuesday, April 30th, and then the next night, Wednesday, May 1st. I remain completely befuddled and confounded by the behavior of law enforcement as it moved from the total absence to heavy-handed action against protesters. I really can't countenance how that might have occurred, though I did see and I did have an anticipation of this because I was at UCLA on April 28th, Sunday, April 28th, when a large group of counter-protesters came to demonstrate against the encampment. And I saw there tensions between the two sides that almost erupted into a melee. I was sort of standing in between the groups and saw a contingent of UCPD officers, University of California police officers, 100 feet or so away, and asked them, like, what are you doing? Can you get in here and help? And they indicated no sense of urgency. That juxtaposition between no action and then an overreaction, I think, points to a fail on the part of law enforcement.
David, in this debate, there has been an overt conflation of the criticism of Israel with charges of anti-Semitism. As the director of the Initiative to Study Hate, can you unpack that for us?
Yeah. Here, I would just say that we have seen, really over the last decade, since the introduction of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, an increasing focus on anti-Zionism as a form of anti-Semitism. And one of the most prominent Jewish leaders in the United States, Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, has also been really pushing the equation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism over the last two or three years. And what that does is essentially reduce much criticism of Israeli government policy to the domain of anti-Semitism. So, for example, if one brands Israel as a racist or apartheid state, which a number of human rights organizations have done, it's important to note to varying degrees, some human rights organizations have focused on the West Bank, others have focused on all of Israel. If you were to make those kinds of claims, you would, according to this new way of thinking of anti-Semitism, be regarded as an anti-Semite. My own sense is that this unfairly casts legitimate political speech, sometimes very important speech for advancing the cause of justice in Israel-Palestine, and assuring the possibility, or allowing for the possibility, of Israel continuing to exist as a state in its own right. All of this conflation, I think, really risks that by labeling all criticism of Israel, that criticism that might serve to correct Israeli government action, as anti-Semitic. Soon we will hear that using the word occupation or annexation is anti-Semitic. We've already heard echoes of that. Without bringing to an end the occupation, without putting a halt to Israel's annexation of the West Bank, there's no prospect for peace. And so the consequences of that conflation are not restricted to a sense of personal injury. They really touch upon matters that have the highest stakes, the possibility of actually achieving some resolution between Israelis and Palestinians. So I think this is something we need to take very seriously. A good number of American Jewish organizational leaders have not acted responsibly.
David, we can't thank you enough for joining us. Your insights are invaluable, and thank you for what you do every day.
Pleasure to be with you, Steve and Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The first week of October here on Audible Sounds on 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section. When Dad injured his back, when your basketball star tore his ACL, opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful, pain-reducing prescription medicines. But most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country. And tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Kevin Amos, and welcome to another edition of Ebony Spectrum. For this week, we have some current news and some reflections on things that brought us to this point. Our first news story is from The Hill.
Hamas has said that it doesn't have 40 Israeli hostages who are being requested as part of a temporary ceasefire deal that's being hammered out. They say they don't have enough hostages to meet the criteria for release. Now, this admission does raise questions about how many hostages they do have on October 7th still being held. Israel says that it's 129 hostages yet to be released. Meanwhile, President Biden came down hard on Israel in his sit-down interview with Univision last night. Let's watch.
I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving here, et cetera. So what I'm calling for is for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into the country.
Now, many media figures on both sides of the aisle are voicing their anger at Israel's actions and the slow response from the United States. First, let's listen to what Jon Stewart had to say on his show this week.
See, this is where Israel's actions get interesting, because you might say Israel's war is different than Ukraine's. Israel's responding to an attack and a hostage crisis. But in the midst of that, they pulled a little something in the West Bank on March 22nd that might be notable. That's not even Gaza. That's the West Bank. So you can't say it has anything to do with defending yourself against Hamas. Let's see if America upholds its rule against taking land.
He's referring there to, of course, an unprecedentedly large land grab in the West Bank, which is a clear violation of international law. Here's a little bit more from Jon Stewart.
Why do we tiptoe around on eggshells? They slap America in the face, and our response is, well, if anyone slapped us in the face, it'd be concerning, that's for sure. I mean, raising a hand to a delicate body part of the face, if true. The verbal gymnastics that the American government must undertake so as not to offend the delicate sensibilities of a country we provide most of the weapons for is... Yeah!
All right, and making some strange bedfellows, Tucker Carlson also weighed in on the conflict as well, critical of the United States' position. Let's take a listen.
And you may be asking yourself, well, wait a second. If Christian leaders won't stand up for the lives of Christians, why have them in the first place? And that's probably a good question. So you would think that in Congress, where there are many self-professed Christians, somebody might be piping up on behalf of their brethren in the Holy Land. But no, just the opposite, in fact. For example, at a town hall event last month, Michigan Congressman Tim Walberg, a former evangelical pastor, said he would like to see the region treated like Hiroshima was treated. Watch this.
We shouldn't be spending a dime on humanitarian aid. It should be like Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
To be clear, as a theological matter, Christianity is not the religion of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's the religion among all world religions that uniquely abhors mass killing.